Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. It's also a little nostalgic. About 30 plus years ago, back when God was a boy, across the street, I was a graduate student in history and also doing a library degree. And I was in a library school course in South Hall. And the professor had invited a new cutting edge book artist to come talk to us about how to read a modern book. And in walked this bad boy with a black leather-bound book with kind of sexy red headbands, just a slight red embossed name of the author, Colette, and then walked us through this really kind of steamy, sexy read of a modern fine press book. And that was the day I thought I should pay attention to this stuff, and that was Peter Koch. So it's all his fault that I'm here, entirely his fault. For the past 2 years, I've had the great pleasure and delight, actually, of working with three remarkable interns from the Corcoran College of Art and Design's Book Arts program. Beth Curran, happy birthday, by the way. Whitney Stahl and Sydney Risen. As part of their project work, they had an unencumbered access to the fine press collection and the artist book collection in the Library of Congress holdings. In exchange, I had the chance to look at my collections through fresh eyes, from the perspective of working book artists, free of old assumptions about aesthetics and value, and honestly somewhat a little naive about the generations of work that had preceded them. Together we launched into a conversation about what it means to read an artist's book. Artists are not journalists, as they reminded me, and the meaning they infuse in their work does not come with a set of directions. From their perspective, close to the bench, an artist's intention could be imbued in the physical details of the book. As discerning readers, we need to look at the visual book for color, light, shadow, texture, sound, weight, structure, materials, pace, scale. The list went on and on. That the devil, and in fact the intention, was in the details. And I think in some cases they were right. That for many contemporary fine press and visual books, the compelling nature of the work is the aesthetic experience, emotional, intuitive. But there is another aspect of the experience that I believe important to explore. What I'm concerned about as a curator is the space between the act of creating and the act of reading. This is a delicate moment in which an artist's work is transmitted, released, comprehended. So much is invested in creating the book that it's well worth extending our efforts to assure that the artist's intentions are being read correctly. Reading is, in fact, a conversation. This book is not what it seems to be. This book is not the sum of the expectations that I bring to it. This book is not to be read as I usually do. This book speaks for itself. This book has not yet told me what it is. You are reading a new book with me. I just acquired it a few months ago. It's still fresh. It's unfamiliar. It's surprising. All three of the interns have looked at it and agree. We all have a gut reaction that this is a really good book, a really important book. There's something compelling that brings me back time and time again to it. I don't quite know my way around it yet. I really want to understand this book. It was listed as a visual narrative that explores earlier times combined with present events. Okay. It's interesting, I thought. At first glance, it's a scattershot of technique, collage, pencil, gouache, inkjet, etching, photogravure, lithography, Xerox transfer, and typing. It is unique. This book is not what it seems to be. It's called The Phalanx Continues to Advance, Volume 7, by Dean Allen Doss, artist and teacher in Charlottesville, Virginia. He must be a painter, I thought to myself when I first opened the book, because it's full of abstract visual references. This must be about myth, maybe, or symbols, or dreams. Are these eyes? Are these eggs? What are these? Maybe it's the unconscious, or perhaps nature. Maybe that's what this is. It's about the destruction of nature and the body. Actually, no, that's not it. This book is not what I think it's about. Well, wait. Maybe it's about ancient conflict, ancient destruction. Alexander is mentioned. There's Thebes, Macedonia. It cites Pindar. It has helmets. And then there's text. but it's a page from the Comparative History of Nations. This book does not read the way I think it does. There are bodies, are they women? Disjointed. Wax pages full of explosions. Color, corrosion. I suspect this page is really important, but I can't say why. This book has not yet told me what it is. Finally, from outside the book, a note from the author. This volume 7 continues a project begun in 1991 during the first Gulf War, when American armored vehicles rolled through the desert near Babylon. I thought, we're not the first to do so. I thought of Alexander the Great and his dreams of the New World Order. There began a series of books, continuing to this day, that explore the history of the Macedonian period. A viewer going through the various manuscripts must negotiate a paratactic narrative, as that the earlier time period is conflated with present events. Among the overall impression I wish to communicate is an unrelenting sense of history. I'm not interested in American foreign policy and how that's played out in various administrations. I'm interested in history as myth and dreams of all unity. Does this book speak for itself? The contemporary artist book has prompted a dilemma. As it propels further and further away from its traditional roots, codex, letterpress, craft, text, the more closely it aligns itself with its own vision and its own voice. The measure of a successful artist book, one supposes, is the degree to which the artist's intended message is highly and rightly transmitted. The more it does so, the more it depends on its own devices in order to make its meaning transparent. This was once a straightforward matter, at least I seem to remember it was, in which we could understand an artist's intentions or a statement was clearly perceived by the reader. In modern artist books, we've now evolved into a very complex dialogue, replete with paratactic narratives. This active conversation, however, is not limited to the contemporary visual book. The same complicated exchange can be provoked by a work firmly rooted in the letterpress tradition. Surprise. Take, for example, Russell's book on specimens of diverse characters, released in 2011. In many ways, Moret's specimens is a logical landing point, as you've just heard, for his longstanding consideration of letter forms in the alphabet. But this is more than a traditional type specimen display book, and you'd be very sorely wrong if you approach it as only that. This book is not what it seems to be. It's a contained work unto itself, admittedly. It's a formal excursion into the alphabet and type, and it's built on what I would describe as a rather elegant intelligence and offers moments of actually extraordinary beauty. It opens with display settings, which you would expect in a type specimen book, a run of short brevure presentations of quotes and text printed in color to produce 19 vivid settings. You've already seen some of them. There are lovely nuances behind these, a sea of color. Here, the orange and yellow that carries the Alice quote into almost a dimensional object, or this extraordinary setting for Horace. To really understand the complexity of this display, we turn to the state proofs to see what's going on behind this printing. Following the format of a type specimen, the second section offers type selections or type setting, text settings, lengthier passages that are beautifully paired with an appropriate selection of typefaces. But this book is not the sum of the expectations I bring to it. It makes the selection of an alphabet a moment of vulnerability, a gesture that is laden with meaning, trace memory. The book concludes with notes on alphabets, a gathering of personal reflections on the selection and design of typefaces employed in that text. This book is not to be read as I usually do. Even in what appears to be a work firmly grounded in the tradition of the letterpress, we are being asked to read differently than in the past. It is telling us that the nature and function of letter forms is recollection. It's experience. It requires our full attention. Our understanding of tradition, materials, type forms, context, processes, image, and text. This book speaks for itself. Our responsibility and our challenge is to hear this conversation and decipher its intentions. Type is something you can pick up and hold in your hand. This is my batch. I actually kerned the type before I photographed it. How one explains why the artist book swerved into this trajectory depends largely on the loyalties of the audience. Although there have been myriad influences and exemplars that shape the contemporary book, most work in the last 50 years either owes its roots and sensibilities to the fine press movement or it references the concerns and vocabularies of the art world and the academy. The letterpress tradition builds and innovates in response to an established sense of craft and the art of type design and printmaking. Because this work directly links itself to a continuum, or dramatically rejects that continuum, it is essentially legible and transparent. Its meaning is readable and evident, at least at a certain level it is. In contrast, when the artist book veers into the sway of the museum, boy, that sounds mean, I don't mean it to sound so mean. When it veers into the sway of the museum, it often relates to movements and idioms that are external to its own mode of production. Its reference is internal and abstract, its meaning is interpretive and experiential. While recent artist books blur these polarities and seek instead a new visual and contextual vocabulary, the task of understanding or reading these works can at times be vexing. It's as if we're moving back and forth along a continuum of notions between book and art as its polarities. As the modern artist book springs into its own form with its own aesthetic and language, the more we're called upon as readers to bridge the distance between the intention of a work and its actual received meaning. But the truth today is that both approaches have pushed their aesthetic and conceptual parameters far beyond what I'm even describing now. Regardless of how they position themselves on the spectrum of the book arts, these works insist that we consider and experience them in new ways. Even when we reach back to early inspirations, to Dieter Roth in his forays into Fluxus, the avant-garde and multiples, or Ed Ruscha with his sort of pop art sensibilities of 26 gasoline stations, we are already reminded that we cannot engage these works merely as passive, informed readers. We are expected to embrace the challenge, to discern and comprehend and ponder until we unearth meaning. Even with these early ventures, we are already being instructed that the codex is no longer to be taken for granted. Such a message is now delivered by hundreds of works that we have the privilege to see at this symposium and fair. Never has the art form been so challenging in its efforts to forge a new vision of the intention and meaning of the book. We can turn to any number of works that challenge the prevailing notion of the book at their own time. In 1998, Mark Wagner's Smoke in My Dreams signaled an instructive example of how the book had been fully transformed in practice. At the time, there was really nothing particularly radical about this book by the writer, illustrator, and bookbinder and his bird brain press that produced it. The letterpress printing, collage, the handwork, they were all familiar. They were cleverly employed. But how the book was read and understood, this was an entirely different matter. There was, of course, the need to contend with the visual narrative and the self-consciously created world of the collage. But the meaning behind the rebellious connotation of smoking, the romantic fugue-like state of the dream that this book refers to, these are wildly dependent on, frankly, who was doing the translating. It remained an open question whether the decisions Wagner made on aesthetic, expressive, or contextual grounds were received as he intended them to be received. What was clear, however, was that the reader was now required to initiate a dialogue with the artist book if meaning and intention were to be properly culled from the experience. What is this book about? Well, that's the dilemma, isn't it? In the moment in which an artist's intentions are released, a dialogue commences. It is here where the private becomes public, where individual expression becomes collective meaning, and where what was voiced is now being heard. The success of Wagner's work, then, or of any of the many artists represented here at the fair, is whether these dialogues are successful or whether the interrelationship of idea, material, and expression has substance, and whether the work imparts meaning beyond the intimate and private act of simply creating it. In a fashion, Wagner acknowledged the approach to the artist book for the reader to be a complex matter. When he released the archive for The Smoke of in My Dreams in 2000, the substance of the intended dialogue was laid clear. The archive's goal was to serve a comprehensive tour of not only the book's production, but to examine as closely and honestly as possible the imaginative and creative process. It is a complex and intricate object that evades quick description. That's the author's comment, not mine. The working archive is accompanied with a narrative of the book from a making to the backstory of its production to an actual discussion of its reception. The narrative, in essence, provides what a traditional reader might have been able to elucidate from a more traditional book. that Wagner has taken the step to release the archive suggests that in this instance, it's actually better that the artist is present when a reader is engaged in a dialogue with a modern artist's book. Looking back now, it seems evident that we've been watching this transformation over time and for some time. We simply need to turn to something like the fine press collections at the Library of Congress to follow a thread of change and innovation, even in the most traditional of forms. Thousands of titles carry us through from Kelmscott to the early English movement and printing, to the American presses, to the California presses, to the present. Many are represented at the Library of Congress by complete comprehensive holdings: Victor Hammer, Bruce Rogers, Gehenna, Granary, Vincent Fitzgerald, many more. These collections are bolstered by archival holdings. This is in relationship to what Wagner was just presenting to us, that allow us to do significant research and give us an opportunity to underline any discussion of what it means to understand the artistic intention of a book artist. My division, for example, holds the archives of two great American book designers, the first half of the 20th century, Frederick Gowdy and Bruce Rogers. We're looking here at a Bruce Rogers text with a Gowdy dingbat design placket that's been sent to Rogers for approval. Rogers, of course, American typographer and type designer, is known for his classical style, his own centaur type, and the production of the Oxford Lectern Bible. Gowdy commands a special place in the American book arts. In addition to his work as a printer, a book designer, and author, he was one of the first Americans to make the designing of type really a separate profession. There's an adage in the archival world: unless you have absolutely nothing to do and a surplus of staff, never, ever, ever open a box. Well, I did. I opened a box in the Gowdy collection because it looked like it needed some modern processing, and I came across a large stack of neatly wrapped newspaper packages tied up like a package with a bow of string. And I thought these must be wood blocks. They look like wood blocks. So I picked it up to listen to that lovely, wet, liquid sound of a page of Gowdy type pine. You should all have this experience once in your life. Enter the Chesapeake Bay American Printing History Association. And what you're seeing there are basically covering my ass as they can reconstruct Gowdy's typesetting. And in fact, we're now planning to do a keepsake with these leftovers. This collection has allowed us to go into research not only to Gowdy's type design, as we have here, but also to make a register of all his ornaments, to track the books that they're made in. This is the kind of approach to what we would think is otherwise static fine press printing that allows us to keep our understanding of innovation alive and to remind ourselves that when we approach something traditional like fine press printing, we don't know the whole story when we're looking at the book. This is about reading at a level of commitment. We can do the same with many other archives. Here, Claire Van Fleet's entire corpus of all her making copies from Janus Press. More recently, we brought in the archives of Bookland, and in the process of working with Russell to acquire his. That's okay to say that, yes? Too late now. At the foundation of the division's book arts collection is the narrative of the story of fine press printing, surrounded admittedly by a rather large million volume collection on the 500 years of printing that preceded it. What we find then is a wonderful context in which we can explore the question of how we read. How do we look at contemporary book arts? How do we understand innovation in a traditional dialogue? With over 100 books in more than 60 years, certainly Gehenna Press is one of the most successful private presses of this or any other generation. Library of Congress holds a comprehensive run of Gehenna, and because of our long association with Leonard Baskin, we also hold a number of deluxe special editions, original manuscripts, woodblocks, sketches, and proofs. What they bring to the discussion is a revelation. In some ways, not a revelation because we read Baskin this way, but it's still a revelation because we see him as traditional in his press work. And yet what we're really seeing is that Leonard saw the letterpress book as an avenue for depiction, as a vehicle for carrying image and forward in a certain way that was both expressive and appropriate to his own designs. Even in the midst of a highly traditional craft, Baskin was pushing the boundaries. consider the images that he did for Capriccio, one of his favorites, largely because of his intensely successful collaborations with Ted Hughes. With 20 poems and 25 engravings, Capriccio is a difficult work on many levels. It starts off as something that seems to be rather joyful. It devolves into a moment in which we're looking at the nature of unmotivated acts and is, in fact, the reliquary for the suicide of two women. A much more traditional page from Baskin, in which we begin to understand, if we look at it in this fashion, how the shape of illustration shapes the sense of text. We go forward to shape text that we're seeing about to come out in Russell's own work, and we realize that there is a continuum and an extension of this experimentation that emerges from a full understanding of traditional craft that allows people to break rules. Well, as it's evident, I'm using the term artist book now to encompass a full range of modern book arts expression, from livre d'artiste to fine press to the contemporary book as object movement. I think we've all left this argument behind as to what we call them. The vast range of works here speaks to the wide arc of meaning and expression that cuts through the approach to the contemporary artist book. Present are printers such as our own Peter Rutledge Koch, Vincent Fitzgerald, artists whose entire careers of work have been devoted to shaping and promoting a contemporary sense of quality and craft, pushing the traditional letterpress book to newer experiences and expressions. The work of younger printers and type designers continue in this effort to push the boundaries while still paying allegiance to technique. Koch, whose work is often transported by the glory of typographical design, can at the same time transform Thomas McKelvey's selection of performance pieces. This is his work, Diogenes Defictions, and transform it into a work that directly challenges our notion of a book, although certainly wouldn't challenge an ancient Greek's notion of a book. These are lead curses and phrases that have been brought to us in a ceramic, is it a ceramic box? Yes. Challenging immediately, coming from a tradition of craft and challenging immediately the notion of a traditional book. Whether it be Russell's efforts to understand the nature of the letter, independent of its relationship to the alphabet, or whether it be Vincent Fitzgerald's recognition that design and materials are integral in relating image and sculpture to the understanding of, say, Rumi's Divan-i Shams, these books engage the reader directly and with full disclosure. Since 1981, with the publication of his first book, Vincent Fitzgerald has produced 50 astounding books in the livre d'artiste tradition. He combines the reverence for letterpress and printmaking that we've been describing and adds to it a mix of a new understanding of text and collaboration, one that often forces the book to take on new shapes and energies. The impressive range of the press's production speaks to the collaboration between an army of visual artists. You're looking at the title page for his very famous Epiphanies by James Joyce, done in 1987. Poets, translators, calligraphers, typesetters, artisans who maintain the traditional skills of papermaking, bookbinding, and typesetting, and then move away from them. He's brought these artists together to print Joyce, Kafka, Sitwell, David Mamet, and most especially Zahra Partovi's translations of Rumi. An example of the range of what this collaboration can bring is to look at the nature of the page that comes out of the Epiphanies. This one, the section on death, referring to a line of poetry that talks about there are no people here, so go elsewhere and dance. And the book becomes, in fact, a moving representation of that performance. It's difficult to fully describe the range and impact of Steve Clay's Granary books. Beginning in 1986, he has concocted a mix of poets, artists, printers, and craftspeople whose work defines an era and fundamentally shapes our understanding of the artist book. Every imaginable technique has been used, each work distinct and appropriate to the text, letterpress, offset, handwork. While we can often look at other presses and immediately identify them as the work of someone, you can look at any number of Granary Press books and be surprised that they come from the same oversight. Take, for example, probably the most famous of Buzz Spector's works, A Passage, done in 1994. This is one of his more famous book manipulation projects, in part because the initial book was specifically produced for this project. That is, he didn't go find a book, he made a book. It is, in fact, a 360-page book, each page identical. The page talks about an artist or an author who creates altar books and then goes into an odd little story about a rabbi and the true meaning of visual comprehension. Spector tore every page, each with a progressively larger stub left behind. The resulting cascading wedge of text is surprisingly legible, though perhaps not to you. Both the book and the text have been transformed and altered. And just as an aside, with an edition of 48 books and 360 pages, Spector tore 17,280 pages to complete this work. From another range of expectation from Granary, Henrik Drescher's Too Much Bliss, done in 1992. In the words of Johanna Drucker, this book has the look of some manic, encyclopedic, New Age Sears and Roebuck mail order catalog of all the elements that have ever existed in the course of organic history and human memory. I think the subtitle of the book pretty much sums it up. Scars, tattoos, and forgotten instructions, everything at once. And indeed, everything is here. Body parts, coffee stains, clumsy watercolor, cryptic hand, latex, rambling thoughts, gestures, collage. Letterpress with extensive collage, drawing, cutting, painting, it raises the question that we were raising earlier. At what point do we understand an avenue of meaning and intention in this work? It requires commitment. I believe it requires conversation with the artist, in this case, for me at least. If one works hard enough, meaning is present. This is the work of Ken Campbell. We're looking at The Word Return from 1996. He takes the form of letterpress printing and printmaking and transforms it into something quite his own. Campbell's texts are often poetic and dark. His approach to the press is almost maniacal. Many of his pages go through the press up to 60 times before they achieve this intense, layered, thick texture of type, furniture, even the found objects, even the press bed, to create his vision. Here we're looking at two lines of poems, the larger one done by brass stencils that didn't kern properly, which meant every letter had to be printed separately. I think that's about 70 runs through the press. Ken Campbell approached the physical gesture with such intensity in making 10 years of Uzbekistan that the act of aggression rises to the level of metaphor in this powerful work. It is evident that the pages have been pounded through the press. You can feel this as you're working with the book. Layers of overprinting obscure and censor images of faces. The nature of the conflict in Uzbekistan is enough to allow us to surmise the meaning of these portraits, but it is Campbell who later reveals to us that the faces of these people that we're looking at are people who vanished during the Stalinist sweeps. Once chronicled by Alexander Rodchenko's album, they are now being obliterated. Each portrait was framed on the press by a zinc plate. The device proved recalcitrant during printing. It's fairly malleable metal. It started popping and lifting as he was printing. Campbell attacked it with a barrage of staples, which I think you can see, leaving the frame with this menacing texture that progresses as the book moves on, that translates to the page. One's emotional reaction to the violent sense of obliteration is particularly profound reading this text, it is for me at least. To be aware of Rodchenko's album sets the historical context, but the real power of Campbell's treatment is its intense journey into pathos and despair and fear. Many artists marshal a suggestive combination of text, image, and shape so as to redefine traditional meanings. They create new disciplines, new viewpoints, almost in a sense as if breaking boundaries realigns vision and reframes experience. Take Colette Fu, Axie Fire Festival, a one-of-a-kind collapsible artist book in which she combines her interest in photography and travel and pop-up paper engineering. Here, the artist book gives her free rein to envision an open, subjective anthropology, where space and time and culture collapse into a suggestive moving cloud of images and shapes. Her Axie Fire Festival, a photographic depiction of festivals held in ethnic groups in southwestern China, collapses the distance between ritual and culture, between time, between ceremony, between participation and viewing. She seeks to eliminate the boundaries between book installation, photography, craft, and sculpture. Of course, not all artists' books point so directly to the wellspring of their origins in the traditional book arts. Some, by rejecting the conventions of craft and by transcending the restrictions of text, reinvent the contemporary artist book as an equal art form and eschew formal rubrics for discussion and critique. Meaning is no longer necessarily supplied. It must be experienced, felt, sensed, unearthed, operated. It can be embedded in materials, expressed in deliberate actions, and registered in form. Of course, we're looking at Keith Smith's very famous series of string books. This is book 91, which was done in 1982. Timothy Ely, in the same fashion, creates a symbolic language all to himself, impenetrable. It took me a long time to get past my inability to read Timothy Ely. And in fact, in a dog and pony show that I was giving to a group of printmakers in Washington, I brought this book out, thinking, of course, this would be news to all of them, and said, this is an example of the kind of commitment we need to make to books. I've had difficulty with this book. I don't think it's transparent. As best I can surmise, it's blah, 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 blah. And in the back of the room, a woman said, well, that's just silly. It's obviously, and then spews out this long scientific discussion. You can see by this, you can see by that. I don't understand why you don't understand this book. I said, okay. Thank you. She couldn't help herself. She said, actually, I worked with Tim for 14 years. Hence my point. So whether we're looking at optical illusions number two, which is what we were just looking at, or in this case, redshift, or even his collaborations with Daniel Kelm, in this case, Investigations, the Four Elements, Air. This is the air element. Tim Ely has this to say about his work. What I'm trying to do is assemble symbols in such a way that a shift occurs in the viewer. Language doesn't have to be verbal or visual. It can be a sensation. It can be in the form of signals. My marks depart from meaning, but they are not meaningless. They just have a different internal matrix. Or it can be about operation or experience. Here, Julie Chen's True to Life from Flying Fish Press in 2004, in which the poetics of the piece actually move as we move the shutter up and down. Or Kumi Korf's Silk and Secrecy from 1985, where the whole book leads you to this moment of revelation, only to find out that the revelation is tied up in silk scrolls, packed into a frame, leaving you with the question, do you read the scroll? Not in my library, you don't. Or Laura Davidson's work, which on face of it is a flux poetry. You spin the wheels, hope begins inside thought, hope changes around chance, hope will come something. Hope is for, in its own right, an experimentation with the nature of language, the nature of poetics. When one sets it into the context of Laura's life and understands the moment in which it's created, it carries a much greater weight and meaning, and it speaks to the point that I'm making. And why this is so important for us to be here today, because we learn this from talking to each other. And for the curators in the room, I will remind us that we are often the people that interpret the works to the world, not the artists. So it's our obligation to really understand what's going on behind this work. Werner Pfeiffer, in his new book, Zippo or Zippo, probably, a series of poems zippered together, each word on a separate panel. You can take it apart and rearrange it in 51 different ways and arrive at 51 different poems. In Dictionary Story, Sam Winston disrupts a predictable narrative, that being the dictionary. Certain words become living characters, and their interactions have significant implications for the form and the meaning of the dictionary's presentation. In essence, we're looking at typographical illustration, but we're also looking at chaos as lawn meets loafing, which meets the jungle. As these words pass each other. That's from 2001. 2010, finishing a work that he started in 1999, the young Mr. Winston had started working on a story or a poem, really. Story or poem, which one do you want to call it? Thank you, story. The process of which he began to gather and save notes, bits of paper, words relating to the work. When the piece finally coalesced in 2010, Winston realized that he had created the history of a document. He created a history of documents that commented on the act of his writing. It's called Orphan. And in making Orphan, Winston chose to present the actual story and what he called the archaeology of the writing process. By cutting out words from his previous drafts, Winston created text clouds that were used to create the final piece. As he has it, it is a book in which you have both the story and its history presented on the same page. We can turn to the likes of his current work, or some of his most recent work, this being Romeo and Juliet, in which Sam has explored the semantics and basically has unpackaged the emotions of Romeo and Juliet, into three emotional states, passion, rage, and solace. The play is in essence broken down into these three categories. He actually typesets the words that attribute to that, cuts them, rearranges them, and creates a collage, a new visual catalog of this emotion. And this, of course, is rage. The narrative is delivered thematically rather than the traditional prescribed order of the experience of the play. As this discussion has suggested, if we are to become better readers of these works, we must enter into the dialogue that each demands of us in order that they be comprehended. Artists' books function differently as cultural objects. The traditions they embrace or reject stem from a host of impulses, many of which have little to do with formal constructions of art. Each approaches the notion of origins, context, and importance from a different understanding of the book as a cultural object. When it comes to artist books, we have only begun to develop a language that expresses fluently our universe of understanding, and in the meantime, book artists have moved well beyond these distinctions. They are foraging a new conceptualization of the book, one that will irrevocably alter our experience of the book as an object and as a conduit of meaning. How we place the work of an individual book artist, or how we point to that which is new or path-breaking, or even how we describe the impetus behind the book, remains for the moment a matter of poetics and borrowed language. But it is by observing, reading, and interacting with these books that we will move closer to a new understanding. I opened with a story about being taught how to read. If you'll bear with me for a minute, I'll close with a story about being taught how to read. In the summer, I have the great privilege of teaching at Rare Book School at University of Virginia. I teach the history of the book from 200 to 2000. Blink and you miss the Renaissance, right? The last, and I think this is generous, the last 15 minutes of the course is devoted to the modern book. The resources for fine press printing and artist books are slim in terms of the kind of workshop books that we can use, but I had at my disposal a book by Johanna Drucker, one that I did not know. The theme of this course through the 5 days is to teach students how to approach a book and read it, have the book tell you what it is, learn to read a book. So it seemed perfect for me to be able to take the book in teaching style, turn it upside down so they could see it, and walk them through how I would read a book I had never looked at before. And frankly, I was really, just on. Look at the text, it was a solidly designed book. Look how it moves. She wants you to go to the bottom of the page. Why? Why is the text changing here? Why is she using these colors? Why is she referencing back to that moment? What is she, if she wants to keep that emotion alive? Let's follow it. See how the emotion changes. Turn the page. She keeps driving us through. We get to, I have no idea what this page is doing. I can't tell you what this page is about. I don't know what this page is about. It occurs to me that Johanna Drucker not only teaches at UVA, but happens to be down the hall. I say, just a second. I run downstairs, the hall, and knock on their door. Could you come and talk to us about your book? Sure. I walk her through. Johanna, class, Johanna. This is what I've told them so far. She goes, yes. I said, and then we go to this, and she goes, I guess I can see why you would go there with that. I get to the open page spread. I said, this, however, I have no idea what to say about it. I don't understand. I don't know why it follows, why you led us to this. And she looks at it for a moment and says, oh, I just thought it was pretty. Thank you very much. Yeah. She's asking, isn't there a problem with this notion that we have to interact? Shouldn't books be self-evident? When I'm talking about how we... is the value of a good artist book one that, in fact, takes you to its mention or takes you to its intention, I think when we arrive at a language, we will be able to discern a successful book from a less successful book. So I would say, yes, I think the best thing an artist book can do is to at least have the reader land in the zone of the intention of the artist, maybe not necessarily everything that informs them. That may not be our business. Art is art, after all. It's not journalism, as my interns kept reminding me. But if I don't know what's going on, then we have a problem. So I would agree with you. I think successful books bring you there in a way, whether it be through compelling visual, emotional responses, something symbolic, something straightforward, but it has you land where I think the artist's expression intends you to land. Now, it may be that artists I mean, I went through art training and I was taught, you know, when the painting's done, when the pot is done, it's not yours. It belongs to another person's experience, and what they bring to your art has nothing to do with you. And there may be that, but I think we've all had experiences with books in which there's an incredible amount of effort and work and art and labor to it, and you're just left I'm just left blank. I don't know what it's about. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. I don't know how to read it. I don't know what they want me to know. I don't know why they made it. And that's what the dilemma I'm talking about. I'm saying it's helpful, especially for curators, if I'm buying a book, to know. Because oftentimes book artists are not, I have 20, any of us who teach in university or institutions will have 12 to 20 people in front of us. And we hold a book up and I say, this is Russell's work. And what Russell is doing here is, I want to make sure I'm telling the truth. Russell's truth, not my truth. Although my truth is important too. Betty. Yeah, it started off with a discussion of Betty calls artists the expert, and that artists are often actually pleased when we come to them with questions that indicate that we may or may not understand their work. She then asked if underlying what I was saying is that I was asking artists to supply more, which I am, but I'm also asking me and readers to work harder, which I think it's, and to quote Claire Van Fleet, because the first time I floated this idea was at the ABC conference, and I kind of finished with this very smug little greenhorn, you know, you should tell us what you're doing. And Claire Van Fleet was receiving an award, and she walked up, and before she accepted the award, she got to the mic and said, "Diminution, the last goddamn thing I'm doing is giving you a piece of paper about what I mean this book to be." So I'm not asking for that, just something in between. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that comment. She's saying that the other side of the dialogue is that artists, sometimes in discussing things with readers, discover things that they themselves are unaware of. Way in the back, who's ever doing this? Way, way in the back. Is that Marshall? Hi. I take what you're saying, although what I was doing was something different than what you've just attributed to me. However, bogus if you say that the material substance of the book has no bearing in this conversation. All I have to say to that is turmeric. Marshall, turmeric. How do I pick a book for my collection? It's actually your collection. I actually listen to Marshall a lot, even though that little, and I'm sure I'll pay for that. I interact a lot with artists, although I do buy from dealers as well, but I have a lot of conversations, and I try to be documentary. So I will, in fact, buy books that I don't necessarily have a complete vibe with or I don't necessarily like, but I think represents something. That's hard to do genuinely, but I try to be beyond my own personal aesthetic taste. I try to look at works that come from different motivations, different factors, different expressions, because I'm not the researcher. I have a large audience of researchers. And because I'm trying to document the American book, I need to be mindful of that. But I pay attention to what artists tell me. I will follow certain trusted dealers, not everyone, and I'll follow through on things that are asked for, but it's not necessarily an easy business, especially when you have a big collection. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm sure if you have a small collection, it's even harder. Yeah. All the way in the back. Hi. Thank you. I had a slide up that said, I give you Socrates human holding up a plucked chicken. It's the same thing. Thanks. Thanks very much.